You know, today I'm going to rummage about in the rag bag of my mind because when I first came up to London to work in the theatre, gods walked the earth. You could go and see John Gielgud, Ralph Richardson, Noel Coward, Vivien Leigh, all sorts of amazing people. And I was very lucky in my life, you see, because I found that not only seeing them, I met quite a lot of them. And so my celebration, my chat today of That Reminds Me, are about all these amazing people that I was lucky enough to have met or indeed worked with. And so I'll start actually with this building, the Jermyn Street Theatre, where we are now. First time I came here, I saw Stephen Parry do a wonderful evening on the life of Emily Williams. Now, Emily Williams is this Welsh playwright. He wrote, as you know, A Night Must Fall, The Corn is Green. And Emily was this wonderfully witty man. And if you put a penny piece on the map of South Wales, you could cover the birthplace of all of us from South Wales, from Richard Burton, Tony Hopkins, myself, Stanley Baker, all of us from the same area. But there's one right up in the north, and that's Emlyn. He comes from North Wales, you see, where they talk in the back of the throat like that, you know. They're very precise, you see. And so this is the story from the beginning of starting here at the Jermyn Street Theatre. I was going up Shaftesbury Avenue one day, and I bumped into Emlyn Williams, and there he was. He said, "Hello, Vic. How are things?" I said, "Well, not so good this year." He said, "Oh, yes. Still struggling to keep your head below water." But of course, the marvellous thing was, the next day there was a cheque for £1,000 in the post. And the letter said, "Dear Vic, as I intend to leave with this in my will, and as I intend to live longer than Hayley Mills, I might as well have it now, love, Emlyn." And what I was actually doing was going to see Binky Beaumont. Now, right in the past, Binky Beaumont, this man ran London's West End. If you were an actor in the 30s, 40s, 50s, maybe not so much in the 30s, yes, you would have to work for Binky Beaumont. He ran the West End. Every star you could think of was under contract to him at that time. Vivien Leigh, John Gielgud. John Gielgud was like, "I never move without Binky." Because, and so I go to see Binky Beaumont. This is the man. Now, the extraordinary thing is this. He ran the West End, but he was never interviewed. He was never photographed. He was never in the public eye. Nobody ever saw him. Nobody ever heard his voice. And now, for the first time ever, I was going up to his office, which was over the now Gielgud Theatre. Then it was called the Globe Theatre. Next, it'll probably be called the Jerry Hall. I mean, there's this tiny lift that you squeeze into, manage two people to squeeze up into this lift, and I'm going up to see the great man, Binky Beaumont. Never met him, never heard his voice, but I went to see him. He was offering me a job, which was to play in The Odd Couple by Neil Simon, which I did opposite Jack Klugman, the other guy who plays Quincy. Anyway, I'm going up in the lift, open the door, and I go to the outer office, and suddenly there in the inner office, I see for the first time the man who ran the West End Theatre, Binky Beaumont. He was on the phone, and he was saying, "Well, I won't say yes. And I won't say no. I'll say, And I turned to the general manager, John Perry, and I said, "What was that about?" And John said, "Oh, he's double-crossing some poor bugger, dear." And of course, Binky represented everything that was fantastic in the West End at that time. He was an amazing man. Of course, Noel Coward. He never appeared in the West End without Binky Beaumont presenting Noel Coward. So That Reminds Me, the first time I met Noel Coward, I was sharing a dressing room with Dan Massey, the lovely actor, no longer with us. And the night before the performance, suddenly Dan is doing his vocal exercises. And he never did that, you see. So I said, "Dan, what's that?" And he said, "Well, I'm very nervous. My godfather's out front, Noel Coward." Oh, I said, "No, really." So anyway, the end of the performance, after Dan had done all that in the interview he was doing, and at the end of the performance, I knocked the dressing room door, and I opened the room, and there was Noel Coward. Never met him for my life. And he said, "May I have a pee in your basin? I can't find a lavatory anywhere." So there he is, in the sink, like this. And he turned to Dan, and he said, "Dan, you've been taking singing lessons. You've ruined your voice." Before all these gods and goddesses, there were two ladies who were my great inspiration. One was Joan Littlewood, Stratford East 15, ran theatre workshop, conjured wonderful shows, things what they used to be, The Hostage, A Taste of Honey, Ode to Lovely War, amongst others. And she always rehearsed in an area of pink lighting because she said actors and actresses are highly decorative and fragile. They are my bird's eggs. And there we were working in this pink light, but there was an element of danger in that pink light because she could be a very demanding and tough director. And one day, a man burst into the theatre as we were rehearsing and said, Joan Littlewood, she said, yes, I want to tell you that a member of your cast killed himself last night. And it's your fault. I ran out of the building and Joan said, oh, God, Vic, get me a brandy, love, get me a brandy. So I got her a brandy. So they said, oh, God, drinking the brandy. Why didn't he phone me? Oh, bugger him, he was a terrible actor anyway. And the other lady that I always give thanks to, Heilwyn Richards, was the lady who ran the Amateur Dramatic Society in Ebbw Vale, where I was born. Actually, I was born in Cwm, CWM. But it's extraordinary. A lot of people never think I'm from Wales because of the name. So I never changed my name. I tell you why. My grandfather walked from northern Italy to South Wales. He only had the money for the boat going across from France to Dover, that one. Because at that time, before the First World War, you see, there were no passports, no barriers, no work permits. You could go wherever you liked. It was only the war that put the barriers up, and they're still up. And so that time, the coal fields opened in South Wales. It was a gold rush. People came from all over Europe, from Czechoslovakia, Romania, Poland, Russia, anywhere, Italy, anywhere, to work in the pits. Because you see, down in South Wales, there weren't any coal miners, there were farmers. So that's how, when the coal fields opened, there was this rush. And my grandfather, God love him, walked all across Europe to work in the pit outside Swansea in a place called Ystrad Gunmais. So when I first came to London, of course, with the name Spinetti, first agent I ever saw was frightfully grand. He was wearing one of those MCC ties and a Garrick Club blazer and a Savage Club hat. With the perfect club man, cricket bats, cross cricket bats behind the desk. And I walked in and he said, well, I said, I've seen your performance. He said, the only thing is, you see, you'll have to change your name. I said, why? He said, well, we don't have that many parts for crooks or waiters. I don't want to change it. My grandfather walked carrying it. I leave that. But a lot of people don't know. For example, in America, they didn't care. It was called Spinetti. I mean, good Lord, there's De Niro and Pacino and Sinatra there or whatever. Anyway, here, first time I ever presented to the Prince of Wales, Prince Charles. He said, they tell me that you're Welsh. I said, that's right. He said, well, I thought I had a cheek with my name, but your name is ridiculous. I mean, he did a real Groucho Marx. Your name is ridiculous. Wonderful. And another man who was then head of the BBC, Director General, Hugh Weldon. Do you remember Hugh Weldon? Yeah. Very Welsh, very Bangor, very North Wales. He always sat. He always sat at a table. He had one chair for his ass and one for his arm, you know. Spread out, expansive. And the first time I came across this man, I was doing a talk show with David Frost. And I'd just come back from America. I'd been working over there. And I'd done lots of talk shows. Then got a lot of letters from people saying, welcome and blah, blah, blah. So I come now. I'm in England. And I ring up. What do I do the David Frost program? It's an evening talk show. And the only other guest was Professor Asa Briggs. Now, Lord Briggs, for some reason. I don't know, but there he is, Lord Briggs. So I go down to the studios, 6 o'clock. I thought, 6 o'clock? The show doesn't go out until 10:30. What are we going to do? 4 hours? It's a talk show, you know. So we get there, and there's Hugh Weldon, and there's dinner laid out. Fine wines, Welsh lamb, and everything else. Sitting there expansively. And then we're chatting away to me, and suddenly he turned to me and said, you have a very interesting Monmouthshire accent, Mr. Spinetti. Where do you come from? I said, Monmouthshire. He narrowed his eyes and he said, my father was the permanent Under Secretary to the Minister of Education for Wales from 1937 until 1949. And I said, well, the education I got, he should be ashamed of himself. And that's why I was never in Doctor Who. Oh dear. They also rehearsed the questions. He sat there and he said, now David, who sat there like a little schoolboy in his school cap with his little clipboard, David is going to ask you certain questions. I said, oh yes. He said, the first one he's going to ask you is, when were you first aware of a state known as drunkenness? My heart sank, because it's like, you know, writing an essay, would you rather live in the town or the country, that sort of thing. So I said, well, when I was 5. Five? I said, yes. I said, I was born over my dad's chip shop in Cwm in South Wales. And I said, on Friday nights, you could hear singing or fighting. And that was when the miners got paid. And I associated drunkenness with singing. So I was aware of drunkenness when I was five. He said, are you going to say that? I said, well, I don't know, I might. He said, well, I wouldn't if I were you. So why not? Well, if you do, the whole of this country will know that your father sold fish and chips. I said, I'm giving him a plug. I said, the shop's still there. People come in next, oh, that Joe, you heard your boy last night. I saw him on the telly. They'd buy more fish and chips, right? Anyway, and then he said, well, come on. He said, you must know stories about people who like a drink, for example. Who likes it. Oh, is it Winston Churchill? Winston Churchill! You can't say that. I said, well, my cousin Elwin was in his guard during the war. And sometimes they used to help him upstairs at night to bed. And my mother said, tired out of his mind. And Elwin said, no, unsteady on his legs. But didn't take away from the man. It was just that everyone knew we liked to drink. Anyway, after that programme went out, I got my one fan letter from the BBC forwarded. And it was unsigned, postmarked Bournemouth. And all it said was, why do we have a foreign bastard like you on British television? Because it's... When I first came to London, as I said, and these gods who walked the earth, some of the big super gods of that time that happened in about 63 when I was doing Old Lovely War, the Beatles. The Beatles turned up. They came and they said, George Harrison said, you gotta be in our film, Vic. And then he said, you gotta be in all our films. And I said, why? He said, well, if you're not in them, me mum won't come and see him because she fancies you. The ease of the 60s. I was in those films because of George's mum, right? And of course, it became a big thing. And when we were in New York, on the opening night of Old Lovely War in New York, there we are. And what I didn't know was around the corner, there was a cinema showing A Hard Day's Night. So I was the first person that anybody could get hold of who'd been in the Beatle film, you see. I didn't know this, of course. Because Beatlemania was rampant in Europe, but in New York it was madness, absolute mega. I don't know if you remember, but it was absolutely madness. So I came opening night. I came out on stage and I was the MC and I come out and I have to say, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Suddenly happened to the gods, I could hear, people screaming. I thought, my God, I thought my flies were undone. Huh? It's not that frightening, I can assure you. And so they were screaming and they shouted, he touched George! I said, okay, to the company manager, don't worry, I said, don't worry. And I said, listen, my darling, this is a serious musical about World War I, all right? So I tell you what, if you at the end of the performance, if you come down and sit in the front row, we'll do a 10-minute question and answer period on the Beatles. Is that okay? Thank you, they said. And they did that for two reasons. One, because I know what it's like to hunger to know something about somebody you really love. When I was a kid, if somebody said the new Flash Gordon, I'd think, oh, what's he like? Or Rita Hayworth, you know. So suddenly there were these kids. They'd come down to the front row and they'd be trembling and crying and shaking. Because, you see, it's the first time they'd appeared. People couldn't differentiate between them. They looked like mop tops, like four fellas under the same wig, you know. So they'd be sitting there crying and trembling. Tell me about George or John or Paul. So I always told them the same story. But when we were filming, I had flu, and they came to visit me in the hotel. And how each of them visited me was how they were different. First person to visit me was George Harrison, who walked in and said, hello, Vic, I've come to plump your pillows. Whenever anyone is ill in bed, they always have to have their pillows plumped. He put me pillows, you see. Then he left. Then John Lennon came in, see, Geil's final, the doctor's coming to do experiments upon you, see, Geil, Heil Hitler, and he left, right? Ringo walked in, sat down by the side of the bed, picked up the hotel menu and said, once upon a time there were three bears, Mummy Bear, Daddy Bear and Baby Bear. And he left, right? Paul McCartney opened the door and said, is it catching? I said, yes. And he closed the door and never saw him again. So that's the story I told these kids. Oh, thank you, because they had some little crumb they could take to the school the next day and they'd be outside. It became a big thing. They used to come from Chicago, Philadelphia, Detroit, from all over the world, all over America, I'm sorry, to fly there just to sit at the end for this little bit at the end. The producer was dancing with glee because we sold out the guards on the upper circle every night with all these kids who just came down at the end. And I'd tell them the story and then they'd be outside the stage door. They'd be standing up there. And I'd come up the stage and they'd say, oh, there he is, Mr. Spinetti. What did George Harrison say? And I'd say, plump the pillows, plump the pillows. Oh, my God. Isn't that cute? What does it mean? One night, Warren Beatty came to see the show, and he was in my dressing room afterwards. And he said, Victor, I have big problems out here. He said, there's a whole crowd of screaming teenage girls at the stage door, you know. If I go out that way, they'll just tear me apart. But I didn't like to say they were Beatle fans. I said, oh, come on, I said, they won't hurt you. Well, we opened the door, and they went, Victor! And they parted, leaving room for Warren Beatty to walk through, totally ignored. You know? I can still see his astonished face today going, looking. My mother and father live in Wales. And as I said about finding things out and passing them back, I've never slammed a door in my life. You know, somebody here about families not speaking, rubbish, I'm not here long enough for that. Anyway, I ring my parents in Wales now. My mother on the phone. Hello, where are you now then? New York, ooh. Want to talk to the dog? I said, no. I said, I want you and Dad to come to New York. Righto. So anyway, I sent them plane tickets, and there I am at the airport, and I can see them coming through customs. They're on a plane in their lives. And as I've seen them coming through, as I'm about to go forward to meet them, about 100 girls come around the corner and went, Victor Spinetti! And Dad said, Christ, what the bloody hell have you been up to then? The one I saw the most of them actually was John Lennon, God love him. Because when I was doing The Odd Couple, remember that play I told you about, the Neil Simon play? A lady came backstage afterwards and said, I'd like you to be in my play. And she was Adrienne Kennedy. She'd written a play, it had some success at the Royal Court called The Funny House of the Negro. And she said, I want you to be in this play. I said, fine, what is it about you? Well, I based it on John Lennon's two books, In His Own Right and A Spaniard in the Works. So I read the thing through, and you saw down the side the stage directions. One of them read, a Christmas tree turns into a horse and gallops off stage. Well, I mean, that's a stage direction, right? So I said, now look, Adrian, John has written fantasy. You've got to put reality to this to make it work. Oh, she said, come and tell Kenneth Tynan. Now, Kenneth Tynan was then the dramaturge of the National Theatre. And said, come and tell Larry, you see. So I went to see Olivia, and Olivia said, you must come and direct it for us, my dear baby. Because none of us can understand it, so I said, has anyone got John's permission to do this? And they hadn't. Yeah. So I ring up John, and I said, the National Theatre want to do a play based on your book. She said, they must be mad. I said, no, I said, I can think of a way of how it can be done. She said, well, you do it. I said, well, let's write it together. John, we'll do it together. He said, okay, we'll work on it together. So after a few days, Olivier sent for me, and he said, my dear baby, I have never really met with Johnny Lennon. I would like very much to meet with him. So I said, okay. So I rang him up and I said, a big sir wants to meet you. So he said, oh, great. Mean yoke will be over tomorrow now. We're standing on the steps of the National Theatre, Olivier in his suit with his watch chain, looking, and this white roller turns up with the black windows and the doors open. Out gets John Lennon and Yoko Ono dressed exactly alike. Her down to there, white hats, dark glasses, white suits, with Olivia saying, which one is which, my dear baby? They come in, they sit in the office, and we're having tea, and after tea, Olivia says, my dear Johnny. And John said, I haven't been called Johnny since I was at school. Olivia didn't hear that shot across the bows. He said, my dear Johnny, if this play is made into a film, and God knows, with your name and dear baby here directing it, if it is made into a film, I must tell you here and now, my dear Johnny, as you know nothing at all about the theatre, that if it is made into a film, I must tell you now, because, of course, I have no experience whatsoever about working in the theatre. If it is made into a film, I must tell you here and now, the National Theatre will own 60% of the film rights. John didn't move. He just looked at him and said, don't you have people that you pay who talk about these kind of things who can talk to the people that I pay who talk about these kind of things? A sentence like ticker tape. And Olivia was furious when they left. Well, they looked like that ridiculous pet. And what is this line here, picking up the script? I wandered humbly as a sock. Well, I said, it's John's version of I wandered lonely as a cloud. He said, are you telling me that a beetle has heard of Wordsworth? And then he said, help, help me, my dear baby. I have fallen into the generation gap. Talking of which, the generation gap, from Marlene Dietrich. Mwah. Amazing lady. I met her in Paris. Do you remember Jeanette Spanier, who was the directrice of the House of Balmain? She used to write these wonderful articles in the fashion magazines. She had this house in Paris. If you went there, there'd be all sorts of people there. I mean, amazing sort of legends. Daryl Zanuck, Danny Kaye, Judy Garland, slightly before my time, but those sort of people would be there. And one day I went there, and she said, this lady wants to meet you, and there was Marlene Dietrich. Elegant, wonderful Chanel suit. She had a glass of ice water in her hand, and she was rolling it down her cheek, looking at me under her eyelids. She said, I've been to the dentist, you know, sweetheart, today, with this ice clinking in the glass, and I don't want there to be any swelling. And then she went, with the glass. Well, she did more with that glass than Madonna could do with things like this, you know what I mean? Most seductive thing I'd ever seen with a glass of ice water. So one day she rings up and she says, I want to go to the pictures. I want to go and see a film called Boom with Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton. And I said, fine, okay, good. So we go over and we get a taxi. Now, this is a present for you that I'm going to give you now that she gave me, so I'll pass it on. Going up the Champs-Élysées at night, there was a big traffic jam, and all the way up you could see all the rear lights of the cars and all the headlights coming down, jammed, gridlocked, nothing moving. And I said, oh, we're going to be late for the cinema, look at this. And she said, oh, sweetheart, look, isn't it beautiful? I said, what? She said, you know, look, rubies going up, diamonds coming down. Which is the most wonderful description I've ever heard of a traffic jam. I've never had been in one since. I think, yeah, well, it's okay. Ruby's going up, diamonds coming down, that's fine. So we go and see this film, Boom. And I said, why do you want to see it? Because it had been out years before. Well, she said, you know, Noel had his face lifted for the film. And I want to see if it worked, if it was any good. So now she's got a big bag of sweets, this lady. She had to have the meeting away, chatting. People going, all she wants is waiting for Noel Coward to appear. And then suddenly there was a big close-up of Noel coming on the screen. So she took out her glasses and leant forward and went, sweetheart, look, he's got two ears on each side. And then we left the cinema. And this amazing lady, she rang me when I was directing the show, and she said, sweetheart, it's your birthday tomorrow. I take you to Maxime's. I said, I can't, my mother's coming, my father's coming, my sister's coming, my brother-in-law's coming. I take them all. Well, my mother arrives on the hotel. Oh, that boat, never going on that boat again. It's before the tunnel. Never. And I said, pull yourself together. We're having dinner tonight with Marlene Dietrich. Righto, she said, so. You can't phase these words. We really can't. And my mother had made a dress for herself, for mum. She could look at a photograph in a fashion magazine. And from that photograph, she could construct a dress. She had this gift for doing that. And so she made this dress for herself in green and one for my sister in red, the Welsh colours, with frills and furbelows and flounces and low in the back and a bit of a train. Really quite an amazing structure. When they walked into Maxime's, it looked like an ambulatory traffic light, you know. And they came in. And Marlene was in a little cute sort of Chanel piece. And she said, oh, Mrs. Spinelli, that dress, you know. Is that a Balenciaga? Yes, my mother said, I saw this pattern in the magazine, it would suit me, so I made it myself. £5 it cost me. Well, £5.50 with the buttons, she said, and I got them. She didn't have to give any market because Pontypridd Market was closed on a Wednesday. She said, oh, yes. So, anyway, there she was, looking at Marlena. She said, no, tell me, love. She said, what do you put on your face, love? Marlena said, well, a little Altima too. Sometimes they erase all over. I said, oh, your makeup is beautiful. But before you put your makeup on, what do you do? Well, I wash. My mother said, in soap and water, never. You want to get rose water from Gerwin Jones, the chemist? It's 50p the bottle. And now she's giving this woman beauty hints, you see. And then she turned to my sister and she said, that hairstyle you have now, that's the latest style in Paris, you know, sweetheart. Yes, she said, I saw it in Elle, this magazine, that it would suit me, so I cut it myself. It's called the Gaulois Bleu style. And then my brother-in-law in his rugby blazer with the Tadiga Ironsides badge and shock of black hair, we call him the Heathcliff of the Valleys. Landhoven said, fair play, Marlene. He said, I've never seen you in the pictures because I'm too young, he said, but your age, you were bloody marvellous. And she turned to my sister and said, oh, sweetheart, I love him. And my sister said, well, have him and I can tell everybody. I won the Tony Award for this Old Lovely War show. You never know, when you're up nominated for things, you never know if you're going to win it or anything like that. And I was invited to the dinner, and there were all sorts of important people up for their part, for shows and things. Anyway, I go along at the dinner, and suddenly the mistress of ceremonies, Carol Channing, gets up, and she's opening the envelope, and she said, and the winner is... Victor Spinelli. I thought, oh, my God, I've got to make a speech. It was Sammy Davis was up for it and Golden Boy also. And anyway, I've got to make a speech. And I thought, I'm coast to coast, live television. So I go up onto the platform and I say, ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to make my acceptance speech in the language of the country of my birth. And, of course, they thought, Italian, hey, you know. Hey, Spinelli, how are you? As you know, I don't speak any Welsh, but all you have to do in those speeches is thank people. And this is how I thank them. Ernaur di yr gyddiwr, bir, chanion is now the ychir, the director, John Littlewood. Ernaur y beth ar yna sy'n hir, the producer, David Merrick. An ar yna i'r ychir, my mum and dad. An or yna o'r ychir, the cast. I came off the stage, people were weeping. Oh, Victor, from that little country. There wasn't a word of Welsh in it. This is John Gielgud, was a wonderful man. He said to me once, well, acting, dear, it's very difficult. You see, it's like spinning a spider. Every night is like a spider. It's spinning the performance, like spinning a web. And some nights, that web is highly irregular. And then he said, last great Gielgud, all actors tell Gielgud stories. That was the marvellous thing about being in the theatre. You could tell stories about these gods, which I've been doing today. And the last one of Gielgud's is this. He used to go and have lunch quite often with Dulcie Gray, a great friend of his, whom I just worked with, in fact. And the first time he turned up for lunch, he was on a walking stick, and the second time he was on a crutch, and the third time he was in a wheelchair. And he turned to Dulcie, and he said, no, Dulcie, dear, I'm almost 96, as you know, and I haven't worked in almost a year. You'd think I should change my agent.